Welcome to Bitcoin ETC, your monthly pass to eToro's Crypto Spotlight, where we delve into the realm of prominent and well-rooted crypto trends that truly matter. I'm Anthony Pompliano, also known as Pomp, alongside Will Clemente, my partner at Reflexivity Research, and we're here to ensure you stay ahead of what truly counts. So buckle up and let's go. This podcast is for information and education purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice, a personal recommendation, or an offer of or solicitation to buy or sell any financial instrument. This material has been prepared without taking into account any particular recipient's investment objectives or financial situation and has not been prepared in accordance with the legal and regulatory requirements to promote independent research. Past performance is not indicative of future results.
All right, guys, bang, bang. You got me and Will here. Will, I thought a great place for us to start this conversation, Bitcoin ETFs, for about 45 days since they were approved, $6 billion in net inflows. Is this a success, or is there still more kind of, you know, waiting that we need to do before we can declare victory?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, a lot of that kind of depends on who's the type of buyer that we've seen. But I would say to date, it seems like the answer has been yes. And I don't even know if the answer being yes or no necessarily matters. I think the more important question to be asking is whether the market perceives that that question is yes or no. And so put out this tweet yesterday, and you mentioned it in kind of this long form post that you put out this morning. But I think at this point, given kind of the price performance after the launch of the ETFs, anyone who's bought a Bitcoin ETF is now up at least 15%, if not more, if they hadn't bought the absolute top of the day of when it launched on January 10th. And so, you know, I think the perception from the market right now is going to be that these things are a success, and then that probably draws in some of these more kind of momentum-based buyers.
And so when we see these buyers coming in, how many of these buyers do you think are like buy and hold, similar to what the Bitcoiners have been, versus they're trying to trade this thing, or they're going to, you know, the first sign of danger, dump it and kind of make these things even more reflexive than maybe they are today?
Yeah, my guess, just given kind of the price action of BTC, I would guess a lot of these buyers lately have been kind of savvy, fast-moving hedge funds, as opposed to maybe pension funds or people kind of passively allocating to BTC with a certain percentage of their portfolio. But we are starting to, and the reason why I say that, I guess, is important to kind of tag in there is, you know, as you know very well, but, you know, listeners maybe not, you know, it takes months for some of these entities and institutions to get board approvals to allocate to BTC or other assets in general. So some of these institutions didn't even think that the ETFs were going to get approved. So I think there's probably somewhat of a lag effect of a couple months of taking of time that needs to be taken for these kind of approval processes and board approval processes for people to start allocating. But it was interesting to see now, posted this morning, this is Fidelity Canada, which is, I guess, noteworthy to say it's a separate entity from Fidelity Investments. But Fidelity recommended that clients should put 1-3% of their portfolio into crypto, obviously including Bitcoin and the Bitcoin ETF that they offer. So it's interesting to see we are finally beginning to note some kind of integration of BTC and crypto into some of these portfolio managers and kind of what they're recommending to their client base.
When you look out at other market participants, maybe miners are like another big accumulator of Bitcoin and potential sellers of Bitcoin. Are they following a similar path to what the ETFs and these institutions are doing, or are they doing something different?
Yeah, I think the miners are an interesting one. So there's like a couple of dynamics to kind of be wary of. One, I guess, is, you know, we had the halving coming up in just over a month. The halving will cut the amount of supply coming onto the market in half, which will also cut, if Bitcoin price stays the same, the USD value of revenue that these guys are bringing in from the block subsidy, not including the fees that are generated and rewarded to miners. But the block subsidy will be cut in half to 450 Bitcoin a day. So in the short term, a lot of these miners will be running unprofitably. But, you know, assuming that the halving has kind of this supply shock effect on the market paired with the demand that we've seen of kind of, you know, just relentless inflows into these ETFs, if Bitcoin price goes up, then that will offset that decline in the subsidy. But I think more importantly, a couple of interesting things to kind of note on miners and why I personally hold a few of them in my own personal portfolio is I think people are maybe underestimating some of the developments that are taking place around Bitcoin, both on some of these Bitcoin L2s that are now getting funded, and we're starting to see some of these going live, And, you know, with things like Stacks trading around all-time highs, I suspect that may garner some attention and kind of mind share around some of these things and maybe shine light on what some of these guys are building. And then the other piece is Ordinals. So we've seen some of these kind of blue chip Ordinals projects absolutely ripping over the last week. For example, Bitcoin Puppets, which I don't have any of, but they've about doubled over the last week or so. And you're starting to see some of these projects really popping off. And that's going to start to draw attention of more speculators coming in to kind of, you know, make bets on these things. So all of that activity combined with some of the L2s that are launching, as well as primarily the Ordinal stuff, I think could be a stronger driver of fees than, you know, what we've had in the past in terms of demand to interact on the Bitcoin base chain. And I don't necessarily know if that's fully priced into these miners. And so that's one thing I think that'll be interesting to kind of continue to watch is, you know, is this activity outside of just transacting BTC itself in the form of these L2s and Ordinals, does that persist? And then there also, you know, what does that kind of translate to in terms of revenue for some of these publicly traded miners?
One of the things that has been very fascinating to me is as these narratives kind of shift, many of the non-Bitcoin, but Bitcoin-related entities have outperformed Bitcoin itself. So Bitcoin, you know, in the last 6 months up 120%. Last year, it was up like 160, 170% during 2023, but the miners were up, you know, 2-3x of that. The MicroStrategies of the world were outperforming. And so in the gold and the gold mining world, we see a separation where gold has performed kind of sideways to slightly up, and the gold miners have really separated themselves and been the better investment. Do you expect that to happen here in the Bitcoin world as well?
I think historically, when you just look at how these things trade relative to the underlying, they tend to just trade with beta to Bitcoin, meaning that if Bitcoin goes up, the miners usually go up more. If Bitcoin goes down, the miners usually go down more. And so in a bull market, maybe you want to hold a basket of miners or kind of crypto exposed equities as opposed to BTC. But then on the way back down, you definitely don't want to be holding them because we've seen them drastically underperform Bitcoin. So I think one kind of mental heuristic that I've developed specifically for the miners, but I think you could also apply this to things like MicroStrategy, which is basically a leveraged Bitcoin ETF. Is these things are very similar to kind of call options on BTC in the sense of, you know, you can't get liquidated on them, but if you expect BTC is going to be trading multiples higher, then you should expect that the miners are going to trade even higher than that. And so in addition to some of the things that I just highlighted around, you know, maybe dark horses with the kind of newfound activity around the Bitcoin blockchain, just in the way that these things trade, I think if you expect that BTC trades higher, you know, whatever your price target is for BTC, I would expect that miners as trading as beta to BTC, would be trading into higher than that.
And when we go and we look at maybe the Fed, you know, this thing I wrote this morning talked about, okay, maybe people are buying Bitcoin because they think that the Fed doesn't have inflation under control and inflation could come resurging back. Is that even remotely close to kind of how you're thinking about it? Like, is this kind of sounding the alarm of inflation resurgence? And so whether it's miners, whether it's institutional investors, the ETFs, like all these things are empowering people to get more exposure to Bitcoin, but really it's like this underlying fear of inflation?
Yeah, I mean, last month we saw, or a couple of weeks ago, we saw this CPI print come in slightly higher than expectations. I mean, the broader trend of CPI has still been down over the last year or so. And then I think the more important thing, though, I mean, I don't really think that matters in terms of at least how I'm kind of positioning my own personal portfolio. When we kind of step back, what really matters is kind of the fiscal situation. We've seen, you know, macro investors like Stanley Druckenmiller, Paul Tudor Jones, et cetera, kind of talking through this, and a couple of macro pundits that I follow closely, like Lynn Alden or Lou Grohman. When you look at kind of the fiscal situation, just the amount of debt that we have in the country, we have to debase the currency to be able to service that debt in nominal terms, of course, not in real terms. And so for the government, and particularly the Treasury, if we can have some degree of inflation, that's actually good for them because they're able to kind of inflate and debase, I should say, debase the debt away. So I actually, you know, they're not going to come out explicitly say this, but I would argue that they probably want some mild degree of inflation. Of course, they don't want, you know, 8-9% like we had at the end of 2021. But I think if it hovers above their, you know, their target that they've been mentioning of 2% and hovers around 3-4%, I don't really think they're going to be that upset about it because actually, you know, if they can get real rates down, basically have, you know, if they could bring interest rates down or keep them flat, and then you have inflation coming down, that actually brings down real rates. And so that actually helps them service the debt. So I would argue that them having inflation slightly higher than what they've been saying their target is, that actually secretly they probably want that to some extent.
And is it unsustainable in terms of the dollar just like, you know, continued trend? And you know, at least maybe in my opinion, I think that Bitcoin has an infinite bid because it is that hard asset. And it's this mix of a hard asset with day-to-day or minute-to-minute liquidity, right? Like you can go buy real estate, hard to do a transaction, got to have a big dollar amount, hard to get out of it, et cetera. Whereas Bitcoin seems like, you know, I can do it with $5 and I can buy it right now and in 60 seconds sell it again. And so is that really what this entire generation of people who are buying this asset have kind of woken up to? Is like, just, you know, I don't know, our grandparents or great grandparents, they're like, buy real estate. Everyone gets rich on real estate. It was the same thing that they were basically trading on. Now there's just a better asset and a better way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it on the nail on the head. I mean, I agree with everything that you just said. You know, I think Bitcoin has a lot of advantages to even something like, gold, which people have held for similar reasons. I mean, Bitcoin beats gold on every single front. I mean, if you go down the list of every property that gold has that Bitcoin does better. You know, I think another piece that you mentioned is the 24/7 trading hours and, you know, ability to get liquidity at any time. I think, especially with these ETFs now, Bitcoin's liquid enough for you to be able to get decent size into these things, and that'll be increasingly true as it trades higher. You know, one kind of, I guess, weird dynamic or something that maybe seems kind of backwards to some people if you say it or silly out loud is that actually the higher that BTC trades over time, you know, of course, if it has really large moves in a short period of time, you tend to see those get reverted, whatever. But as BTC trades higher over time, you actually have it getting de-risked. And why is that? Well, the Lindy effect of it's been around longer, it's proven not to be able to get hacked, etc. The infrastructure gets better. You know, it's more trading volume around it. And then also the liquidity is better. So for a lot of these funds or institutions, they haven't been able to allocate because the infrastructure hasn't been there. But then also the fact that, you know, it's just not liquid enough for them to be able to get in and out. You know, they might move price, you know, several hundred basis points or several percent if they're trying to get in and out of this thing. And you know, maybe that's not ideal for them. And, you know, if it's not big enough, they can't even get, you know, even a couple percentage, you know, points of their portfolio. And then what's the point of even interacting with the asset for them? So I think over the next couple of years, you're going to start to see that kind of de-risking fully take place. And then that also takes place on kind of the psychological level now that you have, you know, BlackRock, Fidelity, et cetera, recommending that you hold Bitcoin in your portfolio. Because now all of a sudden, kind of the career risk has come significantly down. You know, if you were holding, let's say if you're holding Nvidia right now and Nvidia nukes 50% next week, you're probably not going to get fired because everybody on the street either, you know, holds Nvidia or has, you know, given Nvidia the blessing as a good holding. And so I think, you know, now you're starting to kind of see that declining career risk with BTC, with these institutions coming into the space of, you know, before if you had Bitcoin, let's say peak 2021, and, you know, everybody on the trading floor around you was saying that it was a scam and it was worthless, and then it went down 80%. Maybe you'd lose your job. But, you know, Larry Fink's on television saying that you should hold Bitcoin in your portfolio and it goes down, the career risk of you being allocated to it is just significantly come down. So I would say it's de-risk not only on like a quantifiable basis in terms of like market structure and things like that, but also just like the psychology around it.
And the part to me that now is getting fun is like the reflexivity. I mean, you and I did a pretty good job of naming reflexivity research. But basically, you now have people buying. Price goes up. As price goes up, shorts get liquidated. Price goes up further. Then the people who are on the sidelines saying, hey, it's going to go down, it's like, oh, shit, I was wrong. They start to bid it. And you basically get this like super reflexive thing that can go further and faster than people maybe realize. It happens in all markets, right? This is kind of a law of the universe, if you will. But Bitcoin, man, is it more reflexive than almost any other asset in the world too, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we've seen this with Nvidia lately, right? They had this recent massive beat. And so that kind of reinforced the price action that we've seen. And then, reflexivity is basically the feedback loop between price and the fundamentals. And so price going up reinforces the perception of the fundamentals. And then the fundamentals rising reinforces the price trend. And then you get these kind of feedback loops where price way over extrapolates what the underlying fundamentals are, and that goes in both directions. I do think that we're, you know, in the midst of kind of that feedback loop now for BTC. I think, you know, one thing that kind of differentiates Bitcoin from maybe other assets that you do see these kind of reflexive feedback loops in is that Bitcoin doesn't necessarily have, you know, earnings or anything that it's tied to. I mean, you could argue as a commodity, it's tied to its underlying energy cost to produce it. But, you know, obviously it doesn't have earnings in the same way like a traditional equity would. So I think because of that, the reflexivity that you could see in this asset is just unlike anything else in any other asset on the planet. And, you know, Bitcoin obviously is seen these kind of massive parabolic runs in the past. And I would argue that plays a large factor in why. I think that's kind of what we've been seeing here.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw tweeted out recently, and I forget who did it, was they measured price with RSI. And when RSI is at 70, that pretty much like that crossover is when we get into bullish territory and kind of like true on bull market, you know, peak mania. And the average time from crossing 70 at RSI to the peak from a price standpoint is around 1 year. And it feels like that would be, you know, somewhat similar to what people are expecting given the relationship to the halving. And so we now are, I don't know, 50 days, give or take, from the halving. What is your expectation in terms of the impact the halving will have going into, you know, call it the next 12 to 18 months?
Yeah, first on the RSI thing, I think it's an interesting point. I posted this back, I want to say like summer of last year, when the weekly RSI crossed into overbought territory for the first time. And everybody was saying, oh, this is a top signal. And kind of what I said on Twitter is, no, this is actually a signal that counterintuitively that Bitcoin's showing the most strength that it has in over a year and a half. And so I think like typically, yes, RSI in hindsight is always an indication of things getting overheated. But using it in real time, coming out of a multi-year bear market, whenever RSI gets into kind of that overbought territory for the first time, it's not a signal to sell. It's a signal that the market's showing you that it's got actual underlying strength for the first time in a couple of years. In terms of the halving, I don't know if it necessarily has a massive outright impact just on the supply and demand in the market, just because over time, you know, the halving as a percentage of, you know, overall circulating supply has continued to decline. So just the impact that it has continued to decline. But I do think as a talking point, it's awesome. And, you know, a lot of boomers will use that as a way to kind of, you know, justify to themselves that it's a good time to allocate. Also just that, you know, the meme of 3 years up, 1 year down, 3 years up, 1 year down that we've seen around these kind of Bitcoin halving cycles, which is it just the halving? Is it also macro? Is it just kind of behavioral stuff? I mean, who knows? But that pattern has continued and that's kind of become reflexive and like self-reinforcing at this point, I would say. And then the other point is, I guess going back to the halving just being a talking point, Bitcoin is now going to be higher than gold in terms of a stock to flow ratio basis. So not to confuse the stock to flow pricing model that Plan B created and became very popular last cycle. This is just the literal stock to flow ratio of looking at the certain amount of the asset and circulating supply relative to the amount coming into circulation. Bitcoin will have a higher stock to flow ratio than gold after the halving. So it's provably more scarce.
And my last question for you is, now that the suits are here, everyone thinks the fun's over. I've said that. Do you think that Bitcoin's, you know, kind of price appreciation goes down in terms of percentages, or could we actually see the opposite? There's a lot of people saying, hey, this is the super cycle. You know, we're going up. We're going really far up. How do you just think about severity of move, not direction?
Yeah, I think the volatility over like the medium term will probably come down, especially once you have like options around these ETFs. I do suspect, especially the downside volatility, I don't know if we'll see these crazy aggressive, you know, like 30% intraday down moves like even we saw in 2021. I do suspect that, you know, over time, the returns of BTC will slowly decline just as the asset gets larger. But I think, you know, the probability of the quote unquote super cycle, I'm not like calling for a super cycle, but I think the probability of a super cycle is higher than it ever has been. And that becomes increasingly true with every cycle. But the reason I say that is just because we have passive flows now. We've never had passive flows in this asset before. You've had kind of the Bitcoin holder crowd that DCAs into the asset with, you know, pretty de minimis amounts of money. But, you know, now we're talking about pension funds, et cetera, passively allocating 1-3%, if not more, of their portfolio. That's something that's benefited equities, especially after, you know, when indexation rose in the 80s for decades now. And that's part of, in addition to just, you know, monetary debasement, that's partially why stocks are just programmatically destined to go up and to the right, is because you have these passive flows that are price agnostically buying equities 24/7, but every day. And so I think now you're going to see those flows also enter the Bitcoin market. And so that could, you know, the market structure is different. And it's always dangerous to say this time is different, but the market structure and type of buyers that we now have and are going to have over the next couple of years are actually, you know, they are different than what we've seen historically. So I think my big two reasons on why the volatility, A, derivatives around, especially options, around the ETFs. Second, just the size of it.
Where can we send people to find you on the internet or find out more about Reflexivity Research?
Yeah, sure. You can find Reflexivity at reflexivityresearch.com or on Twitter at ReflexivityRES. My Twitter is W Clementi III.
And I am at A Pompliano on Twitter as well. I appreciate everyone tuning in, and we'll do it again next month.
You've been listening to Digest and Invest by eToro. For more information, use eToro.com.